welcome to the Devin Nunes Podcast. Breaking through the political noise, separating fact from fiction. From the San Joaquin Valley, the breadbasket of the solar system. Here is your host, Devin Nunes.
Welcome back to the Devin Nunes Podcast. This week we have back on Tom Joslin. He's with the Foundations for Defense of Democracy and Rights at the Long War Journal. Tom, there's been a lot going on specifically on Iran, and there's nobody in the world that's a better expert than you on the Middle East, especially it relates to Al-Qaeda, Iran, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the base layout across the region. You've been studying this since after September 11th, 2001, when you really got into this and started tracking Al-Qaeda, then turned into ISIS. And so I'm sure you're very happy to see Soleimani off the battlefield. But Tom, why don't you take us first, what do you think about the strike? What do you think it leads to and where are we headed next?
Well, thank you. I think, and thanks for having me. I think the strike against Qasem Soleimani was a long time coming. For anyone who's been watching the region for all these years, it was well established that he led and built a terrorist army across the region. So they had irregular sort of paramilitary or guerrilla fighters. He did, Qasem Soleimani and the Iranians, in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, even parts of Africa, all the way into Afghanistan. Really, this was sort of a very large terrorist force that he had been building and grooming since 2003 to take on America and its allies throughout the region. It's interesting, when you look back at the whole debate over the Iraq war and everything that's going on here, one of the big lessons that, of course, Americans have taken away from all that is we don't want to do another big, expensive, costly in terms of blood and treasure project like the Iraq war. I certainly agree with that. But what I think is lost in what I've seen a lot of the conversation that's been going on here is that one of the reasons why that whole project became so costly and so disastrous, really, is because of Qasem Soleimani. This is a guy who really made it his business to cause as many problems as he could for the Americans in Iraq and our allies in Iraq, while at the same time expanding Iranian influence in the country. It's interesting, you go back through the history of all this, and there were a couple of books that are written I think are interesting to show you what policymakers were being told as the Iraq war approached in 2003. And Tony Blair, the former prime minister of Britain, his memoir includes some insights into what intelligence officials were telling him. And one of the things that he was told was that the Iranians would seek stability in Iraq and would seek to basically quell things after the ouster of Saddam. And then essentially they'd be a force for peace and stability in the country. The truth was exactly the opposite. And part of the reason why the truth was exactly the opposite was because of Soleimani's project, which was to try and expand and successfully expand Iranian influence in various ways throughout post-Saddam Iraq. So this is a guy who had a lot of blood on his hands. A lot of Americans perished because of him and his proxies. A lot of Iraqis, Yemenis, Syrians, Iranians, and others.
Dive down into this a little bit. We had on Mac Thornberry, a top Republican on the House Armed Services Committee last week. One of the things we talked about was Soleimani's longtime involvement in Iraq. But one of the things that we didn't really get into too much was the proxy groups that he has in Iraq. And specifically, one of those leaders was actually killed in the same strike with Soleimani. And maybe our listeners probably haven't heard those specifics because you've only heard about Soleimani. You haven't heard about who Soleimani was riding with in the car that was killed at the same time.
Yeah. So I mean, one of the ways to think about this is that in Iraq, one of the things that was stood up as sort of a security force in Iraq were these popular mobilization forces or popular mobilization units. And this is sort of a paramilitary type of force that was meant to provide basic security in different areas and end up becoming a lead force in the war against ISIS, the fight against ISIS. Well, the problem was that Qasem Soleimani and some of his subordinates held key positions within the PMF. They really greatly increased Iran's influence in the security structure of Iraq by taking over these key positions and leading forces on the ground. And one of those guys who was killed alongside Soleimani is known as Mohandas. And Mohandas was one of these guys who was answer to Soleimani for many years. He was a leading figure inside the PMF and also led one of the Iranian-backed paramilitary groups, now it says in a terrorist organization in Iraq, that's the Hezbollah brigades. There are other groups like that that are throughout the other militia groups that are throughout Iraq that answer to Iran. And this was sort of the modus operandi for the Iranians and Soleimani, was to basically build these paramilitary militias, you know, sort of a guerrilla fighters that they could use to their own purposes that would serve in multiple roles in Iraq and elsewhere. And it was a big problem that I think certain analysts were warning about all along that this was going on. But unfortunately, as a result of the campaign against ISIS in particular, the U.S. ended up relying a lot on these groups to fight ISIS. And so they were seen as a de facto ally. But as you know, Congressman, just because the enemy of my enemy is not always my friend, sometimes the enemy of my enemy is still my enemy. And that was certainly the case here, where these groups certainly made gains at the expense of ISIS, but that didn't make them friendly to us.
And Soleimani, just so we know, he had been designated a terrorist, but so had Hezbollah in Iraq. They had also been designated a terrorist. So I don't think a lot of people realize that you had two designated terrorists from the United States that had blood on their hands, had developed the improvised explosive devices that killed hundreds of Americans. I think it's actually probably well over 1,000, but you know, there's a lot of deaths that we just can't quite get to who was responsible for developing the IED. But for sure, thousands were maimed, including some of my own colleagues that serve here in the House with me now. So this is someone that had serious blood on his hands, but was riding with a well-known terrorist. Probably, I'll ask you, Hezbollah in Iraq, is that the number one go-to organization for Soleimani? Are they the top group, the top militia group that done the most damage over the years, or one of the top? How would you describe them?
Yeah, this is the Hezbollah Brigade. They have a similar branding to Hezbollah, and it's sort of part of the pantheon of Iranian groups throughout the region. They certainly are one of the top Iranian groups in Iraq and one of the top groups targeting Americans. But, you know, I think what you pointed to there, Congressman, about all this is a very simple point I thought was missed in a lot of the debate. There's a lot of discussion in Washington elsewhere about the authorities used to kill Soleimani and his comrades there. And it's an important point that once they're designated terrorists, of course, those legal authorities are in place. And it's interesting, looking at this strike, this wasn't a strike against Soleimani inside Iran. This is inside Iraq, where he's had been operating with impunity for many years. I do think this administration and the president deserve credit for taking him out after all these years. I mean, this is a guy who killed and maimed, as you said, so many different Americans, including in recent days, you know, an American contractor was killed by one of his proxies. They had stormed the U.S. embassy. I think there's no doubt that they would have continued to have come after American interests and assets and personnel in Iraq, and still will even after the death. I do think this restored sort of a degree or a measure of accountability and deterrence. This is a guy who was gallivanting around the Middle East and prancing around as if he owned the place in Iraq and elsewhere with impunity for many years, killing Americans at will. And there was never, other than sanctions and designations, there was never any real comeuppance for him. And finally, he got it.
I have two more questions to go through with you. The first is, you've seen recently protests in Iran, and I want to talk about those protests a little bit and have you get into what you're following, what you're tracking at the Long War Journal, what you make of those protests, because the mainstream media is ignoring what those protesters are saying. And I know you have the ability to translate Farsi language. I know you have people that can help you read some of the slogans and what's being said. And then I also want to follow up a question about al-Qaeda and Iran's involvement with al-Qaeda. But first of all, what do you make of the protests that have been held in recent weeks after the Soleimani strike?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You see, the first narrative that got set was that the Soleimani strike had sort of united Iranians in their anti-American animosity. And I think some of those protests, or a good number of those protesters, probably were legitimately angered by Soleimani's death. I think there was sort of this effort to minimize that and say they're just being forced to attend these rallies. I think some were probably forced to attend, sure. But, you know, look, Iran's a big nation with multiple constituencies. It's not a monolith. So you do have people who were actually angry over this and were sort of protesting America after this. But what's interesting is that there was this backlash protest as well, which I think it's just as credible to say, to look at the evidence, including the videos online that we've been studying, that show that these protests are sort of organic and are also angered by the regime and the regime's sort of not only its adventurism abroad throughout the Middle East, in which Soleimani was the main figurehead and the main orchestrator of. Not only were Iranians angry about that because they spend money on Hezbollah and all these different militia groups and expanding their Islamic revolution throughout the region, but they're also angry with what the regime does back at home, of course. And there's always been popular discontent now repeatedly against the regime in that regard. What I would differ from, I think some of the analysts are going on, there are certain people who look to dismiss that. There are other people that look to make that into everything. I think based on the evidence I've seen, we don't really know how widespread this stuff is overall. We know that it's significant. We know there's enough evidence to say it's significant. But to say that it's going to sweep the regime from power, I think is a stretch. But it's also a stretch to say that based on the current amount of evidence, that it's insignificant and doesn't matter. I kind of come down between those two points. I think it's worth watching to see, you know, how much more these gains steam.
And it's very hard to topple a regime, as we've discovered in North Korea with sanctions that have been going on for decades, Cuba, the latest example with Venezuela. No matter how poor a country can get, if you don't have guns or access to weapons, it's very hard to overthrow a well-armed military. And I think that's the challenge that the Iranians have. If there was some type of armed resistance, it would be far different than what they have today. But it's almost impossible to, I think, take on this Iranian regime when you had just estimated Soleimani was responsible for killing up to 1,500 Iranians who were protesting in the previous month. Is that accurate?
I mean, I've seen that estimate. Yeah, I think the point there, to further your point or buttress it, the point is that the IRGC and IRGC Quds Force and the various different proxy arms of the Iranian regime or militant arms of the Iranian regime have been responsible for both maintaining order internally inside Iran. So they use suppressive tactics to maintain order. And it's those same sort of tactics and the same sort of agenda they export outside of Iran. The IRGC, just so listeners remember, is really short for an acronym for the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Well, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is both in charge of protecting the Islamic Revolution at home against internal dissent and then also exporting it abroad. And sort of Soleimani is a figure or a character who sat at the nexus of those two interests. And so there is some overlap here between those two agendas, and that, you know, the Iranian people who are protesting the regime and Soleimani and the aftermath, including the shooting down of the civilian airliner, you know, they have legitimate grievances against the regime for doing to them what the regime does abroad to others.
So, Tom, you're there's nobody better than you on the Middle East. And last year you came on the podcast a few times and we did cover this, but I think it's worth going over it again. And that is the involvement and the help that Iran and the IRGC gave directly to al-Qaeda operatives. And you did some of the preliminary work on this. You were the first one I remember years ago to bring this to my attention when we were actually being told by our own intelligence agencies that there was no intelligence that showed any involvement of al-Qaeda in Iran. And of course, al-Qaeda is Sunni extremists. And there was doubt by all the eggheads and all the swamp creatures and all the people that work at all the think tanks and get paid big bucks. They continually told the Congress and advised the Congress, oh, no way that's happening. You and Bill Raggio and just a few others were saying, no, we actually have seen evidence of things that we're picking up that you were all following that said, no, al-Qaeda was indeed transiting through Iran. Can you just give our listeners again just kind of another quick tutorial about how that all occurred and then how that was ultimately uncovered and you proved it to be true?
It's interesting. If you actually look at the evidence, that this sort of duplicity on Iran's part, and it is duplicity because, you know, in many areas of the Middle East, particularly Syria and Yemen, the Iranians and al-Qaeda's arms are at loggerheads. They're fighting each other. And there's certainly numerous episodes of antagonism between the two sides. So nobody should downplay that. And of course, we aren't. And the other point I'll just make preliminarily is that, of course, one of the conspiracy theories you see in Washington is that to raise this issue, you're somehow trying to cook the books for a 2003 style invasion of Iran, just like Iraq. And I can just say unequivocally, once again, for the record, that is utter nonsense. This is an issue that just deserves light because I think transparency is the best disinfectant. And when it comes to this relationship, which is an interesting relationship, I find it interesting. You know, we're just talking about Qasem Soleimani, this longtime head of the IRGC Quds Force. Well, there's evidence about his own direct role in working with and sponsoring and helping providing safe haven for al-Qaeda. There's a book out called The Exile, written by two authors. I think one is Kathy Clark, I want to say. I'm probably going to butcher their names now. But in any event, look up the book. It's called The Exile. There's a lot of testimonials, or a number of testimonials in that book about the role that Soleimani played in harboring one or more of bin Laden's sons and working with senior al-Qaeda operatives and providing them safe haven. At times, that safe haven could get testy and become contested. But there's a large body of evidence that we've been working to accumulate through the years that show that Iran has, in fact, provided safe haven and safe harbor and safe transit for al-Qaeda operatives. And interestingly enough, Devin, one of the more interesting aspects of all this is that July 28th, 2011, the Obama administration actually formally recognized this relationship when they came out with a terrorist designation saying that Iran has an agreement with al-Qaeda that allows al-Qaeda to maintain its quote-unquote core facilitation pipeline in Iran. This allows al-Qaeda to move personnel, funds, and communications through Iranian soil to different points, to and from different points in the Middle East, to and from different points in South Asia. And what's interesting about that is that that designation was the beginning of a series of designations outlining that whole thing. As you said, there were people in Washington who were downplaying this and dismissing this, but those designations are actually based on an interagency review of intelligence. So the actual best intelligence we have came to the same conclusion that I came to, that Bill came to, and others have come to through the years about this relationship. And one of the things we found, Devin, I know you fought to get the Bin Laden files released from the Obama.
Well, and before you finish up on that point,
sure.
One of the key things is we knew about that 2011 declaration. And when the Obama administration was trying to strike this deal with Iran, they didn't want that to come forward. And the times that I questioned about that, they either downplayed it or said they were reassessing. They said they were looking for new information. But the fact is, now we find out later, they were sitting on the information and they didn't share it with us. And it wasn't until, which I know you're going to go into now, with the Bin Laden documents. And I'll let you explain once again what those documents were, how we got them, and how we ultimately figured out what was in them.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I mean, there are different parts of the U.S. government, right? I mean, the White House and sort of the Ben Rose National Security shop there that was pushing very hard for detente with Iran, really sowed, I would describe it as disinformation on this topic, among others. However, at the same time, the professionals at Treasury and State who were just doing their jobs and doing them well actually reviewed the intelligence and came out with a series of terrorist designations showing what was going on. And we found out through our sources that the designations, when we see them sort of start popping up, we're wondering, well, what's driving this? And there was a large body or a mosaic of intelligence that was used to justify these designations. And part of that came from the Bin Laden files. And so I just mentioned this designation in July 20, 2011. What's very interesting is the key figure in that designation is an al-Qaeda operative known as, or one of several key figures, is an al-Qaeda operative known as Yassin al-Suri. Okay. Yassin al-Suri was, at the time of the designation, based in Iran, and he was running this pipeline for al-Qaeda. Again, this is according to the Obama administration's own Treasury and State Departments, was running this pipeline for al-Qaeda inside Iran. Well, lo and behold, when we're combing through the files that came out of Bin Laden's compound that the Trump administration finally released in 2017, one of the files we found was the personnel file for Yassin al-Suri. And of course, where was he located at the time the personnel file was compiled? But inside Iran. And it provides numerous details about him and how important he was. And this was a personnel file that was handed to Osama bin Laden. And it had the top 20 or so figures that were sort of facilitators for al-Qaeda in this file. And I'm going to release this file to the public so they can see it, even though it's online, sort of buried in all these this maze of files. But I'll put it up there for everybody to see at one point, including our translation. And you can see that this is one of the pieces of evidence. It's just one. There are many. This is just one of the pieces of evidence that are used for these designations. I think the point of all this is we should be able to talk about these relationships and what's going on in terms of enemies of the United States of America without all of the sort of, you know, histrionics about trying to gin up a Iraq-style war or something like that. The bottom line is here was firm intelligence recognized by Treasury and State Departments that under Obama that show that these two do have an agreement. And despite all the disagreements between them, despite all the antagonism between them, they do come together at times. And this is an interesting example of that.
Well, this is one of those times where the enemy of my enemy is definitely my friend. I think the Iranians and Soleimani were definitely willing to help al-Qaeda out if they were, as long as they were going to help attack Americans. And like you said, Tom, it's guy should have been gone a long time ago. And thankfully, we had a president that was willing to step up and make the right decision and probably had limited time to kill both Soleimani and the Hezbollah leader or former leader in Iraq needed to be done. So, Tom, where can they – when are you going to come out with this? Is this long at thelongwarjournal.com where you'll be able to follow you and read?
Longwarjournal.org. We're going to put up a series of files that we've located. There's this sort of this maze of files was dumped online by the CIA in 2017, and it's just a jumbled mess, and it's taken us a lot of time to go through them. But our whole point about all this is transparency, transparency, transparency. And so we're going to put stuff up there for people to see for themselves so you can see how complex this whole thing is. But I would say this about the Al-Qaeda side. What's interesting about it is as America's looking to retrench and sort of get away from the 9/11 wars, I think most of that pivot away from it has already occurred, by the way. But as America looks to do that even further, the looming issue here is how do we devote at least some resources and some effort to still combating Al-Qaeda and ISIS, because Al-Qaeda is still very much alive. And that's part of the story that we document. In fact, you know, just earlier this month, three Americans were killed in Somalia by Al-Qaeda. And that story was sort of dwarfed by the Soleimani strike and what was going on in Iraq. But Al-Qaeda is still out there and lurking. Yeah, and we just encourage everybody to.
And that's one of the big challenges that we have moving forward is there's a vast open space all along North Africa, down all the way into Nigeria. And I'm talking about from the east side of the African continent all the way to the Atlantic Ocean on the west side, where Al-Qaeda is building a very sophisticated network there. As you said, it's very complex, but they haven't gone away and they're taking advantages of poor governments, wide open spaces, drug trafficking, kidnapping. You know, the challenge is that if they go unchecked, everybody knows how porous our borders are, how porous some of these countries are and how easy it is to get passports. It's not like Americans can't be struck, and that's why we have these forces out there. We don't have to we don't have to move hundreds of thousands of troops, but we do need those capabilities. And thank God we have men and women who are willing to step up and do it, where we hopefully have good intelligence to keep them safe, but at the same time be able to hit bad guys like Soleimani who make all this possible. So Tom, thank you for once again coming on the show. We continue to get more and more listeners. I want to thank all the listeners out there. And Tom, any closing arguments, discussions?
Nope. Just thank you for having me. And I think the bottom line from my perspective is, you know, there's a very raucous debate going on about war and what is in America's interest and what isn't and all that. And I think that's all very healthy for the most part. I just would say that going forward, you know, we still, you know, even though America doesn't really want any of these Iraq-style wars anymore, and I certainly don't, and it's sort of natural to want to, you know, move back from a war posture as many want, I think bottom line is there's still enemies in this country who are lurking out there like Soleimani, and the idea that you can just ignore them, which some want to do, I think is foolish.
I totally agree with you. Tom, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you.
This is Devin Nunes. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Devin Nunes Podcast. We invite you to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And remember, you can download this podcast on iTunes or at devinnunes.com.
Storm clouds been gathering so long, I don't know.
The darkness around us leaves no easy road.
We started wondering if every road dead ends our dreams.
It whips the dust up and rains pouring down.
Good people struggling in every hometown.
We started wondering if we even matter at all. That hard road to happier days. 'Cause we kept our American faith.
Now it's not our first trial by fire like this.
It's nothing hard work and family can't fix.
We've got the power to save it all here in our hands. Take that hard road to happier days. 'Cause we kept our American faith. As we, the people, free and strong, fight through the dark night toward the dawn.
That's why they call her the home of the brave.
With a prayer and a purpose, we're already half the way there. We'll take
paid for by Devin Nunes Campaign Committee.